Paid for by IMIC Incorporated.
The Cure with Amy Cabo is brought to you by IMIC Research. Life can bring many difficult situations, domestic violence, addictions, poverty, and even sexual abuse by your loved ones. Welcome, Amy Cabo and The Cure.
Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us today. This is The Cure, and I'm your host, Amy Cabo. We're live every Friday at 2, and you can always join us by asking Alexa to play 880 The Biz. We created the show so that people will know that there's hope after going through difficult circumstances or difficult scenarios. We discussed powerful topics and had incredible guests over the course of the last months. We have talked about abuse, how to overcome it, prevention, post-traumatic stress disorder, its symptoms, available treatments. We have talked about mental health problems and many others. Basically, if you're suffering from anything, whether it be physical or mental, if you're suffering, this show might be able to help. And we like to educate as well. We like to also offer information about living well and life while healing and after healing. And as a survivor, I hope to inspire others to encourage transparency and find strength in knowing that those who suffer are not alone, and that those that heal against an insurmountable odds do exist. Today, I'm joined by my co-host and partner in life, Dr. Boris Nikolov.
Hi.
And we have a surprise guest, our gift from God, Michelle Nikolov.
Hi, I'm back on the show.
So we know that April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and today we have a very special guest, Taylor Piles, who's a detective with the Annapolis Police Department and is assigned to the Criminal Investigations Section. He primarily investigates child abuse, child sex offenses, and other crimes against children. He has been working for Annapolis Police since 2003 and has been a detective since 2010. Taylor serves as a court-appointed special advocate in Anne Arundel County as CASA. Taylor works to be a voice for children who are in foster care and ensures their needs are being met by the court system as well as all the parties involved in the child's life. Additionally, Taylor is chair of the Children's Justice Act Committee at the Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention, and is a member of the Anne Arundel County Child Facility Review Team. Anne Arundel. Personally, Taylor is an adult survivor of abuse who was removed from his home just before the 8th birthday by Department of Social Services and placed into the foster care system, something I'm familiar with. Taylor remained in foster care until going out at the age of 18. And as an adult, Taylor was troubled by seeing the negative outcomes of those in which he saw in foster care or he was with in foster care, and these included multiple drug overdoses, suicides, incarceration. And based on these outcomes, Taylor did launch the Blue Ridgen Project as a resource for adult survivors. Over time, Taylor recognized additional needs of abused and neglected children in our community and implemented programs to serve abused and neglected children, providing training resources for professionals who regularly work with children. How are you, Taylor Piles? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amy. I appreciate you having me on the show today.
Thank you. Taylor, I had a curious question for you. If you can tell us a little bit about what it is that you investigate, what do you consider abuse? And if you could please could describe to us at what point it becomes abuse, at what point it needs investigation or further looking into.
Well, typically when we get a report of abuse, and the definition of abuse can actually vary just a little bit. So most of the cases that we see are child neglect cases. And when it comes to neglect, it's more of a willful neglect, if you will, where parents or caregiver intentionally neglects a child or knew or should have known and done a little bit more. We also see a tremendous amount of child sex offenses when it comes to those, and then physical abuse cases as well. Obviously, with child sex offenses, there's an automatic investigation with that that takes place. With physical abuse cases, a determination needs to be made, does it actually meet the criteria for abuse? There are a lot of parents that still believe in physical discipline and things like that. So
corporal punishment.
Yes. So with corporal punishment may not always meet the criteria for in a criminal matter for physical abuse. However,
so at what point is it abuse? If they think corporal punishment of abuse, what point is it that it's abuse?
Usually,
I mean,
we look
belting with a belt.
Any type of injury is usually what we look for.
So if it leaves a mark or a bruise.
Yes, for the most part.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
But oftentimes, with those children don't always have to be removed from a home, and oftentimes those parents don't necessarily have to be charged with a crime and things like that. Oftentimes these families just need resources. So we see a lot of parents, they were physically disciplined with corporal punishment, sometimes severe as a child, and as adults, they tend to oftentimes do that to their own children. And sometimes it's a matter of just working with the family and providing them some alternative methods to discipline and things like that, so it doesn't always have to resort to physical discipline. And same thing with child neglect. Oftentimes with neglect, sometimes it's just a family that is struggling with resources, and if there's a way to help that family, that's kind of the goal. So with that, obviously if it's serious or if it's willful neglect, then it'll turn into a criminal investigation. But oftentimes it's just it's families in need of some resources and some help.
But that's great that you started the Blue Ribbon Project, you know, for adult survivors. That's excellent. And I also see that you follow children throughout when they're put in the foster homes. And I know from personal experience, when I was orphaned at 15, I did go through different foster homes, and there was nobody checking up on me or seeing how things went or making sure there wasn't any further abuse that occurred. And I'm glad that things are getting better in that sense. I wanted to ask you, how can an untrained eye or a person that's not familiar with abuse know that a kid is being abused when it's not visible?
That can be a challenge at times. Usually, you know, what I tell people is if something doesn't feel right or if something seems out of place, we need to ask more questions. It doesn't necessarily mean that abuse is taking place. Or that child is being abused. But if something doesn't seem right, your intuition is telling you that something doesn't seem right, that's often the case. You know, that's the I don't really like to use these words, but the good thing about physical abuse is often those injuries are there, they're visible, and that's what gets somebody's attention. When it comes to neglect, that's kind of the same thing. People observe what's going on with that. But unfortunately, with things such as child sex offenses and all of that, there's not going to be any injury that's readily visible to somebody, and you may not be aware of what's going on until the child discloses. But oftentimes we'll see, you know, with those children, kind of the way they act, something doesn't seem right. Oftentimes with those cases, if a child has more of a knowledge than they should, more of an adult knowledge, then we need to ask questions about where did they learn that. Mm-hmm. So that can be a challenge. And one of the things that I find in my investigations is when a report is finally made, we learn that the abuse had been taking place for quite some time. And that's when people kind of have that aha moment. I knew something was wrong or something didn't seem right, and they didn't act on it. And then, you know, you find that out kind of later when everything comes to light. With that. So it's important for people to kind of ask some questions. If, you know, if something doesn't seem right, to ask questions of that child, you know, do they feel safe at home? You know, those sort of questions. You don't have to necessarily focus it towards any type of abuse. They may have other things going on. They might be suffering from depression or what have you. So it may not necessarily be abuse. But if something doesn't seem right when you're interacting with that child, it's okay to ask some more questions and just be observant as to what's going on. And then if you do suspect something, it's important to report that. The great thing about our mandated reporting laws and things like that is if you're incorrect, that family can't come back after you or anything like that.
There's, you're protected.
Yes. There's nothing wrong with making that report because you could be wrong about it. Unfortunately, a lot of times people are right. Mm-hmm. You know, they suspect something and they make that report. They're worried about the family coming after them and that sort of thing, coming after them legally and that. So that's where a lot of the reporting laws kind of take that out of their hands.
Yes, I would say better safe than sorry. And one of the things that I try to stress on this show is the importance of communicating with your children and educating your children, letting them know what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And that could help prevent abuse in any way happening for a long time. Because besides the manipulation tactics that the perpetrator uses, it's also the knowledge, the fact that the kid has no knowledge of the fact that what's happening is wrong.
Yes.
So can you tell us, I read also on your website that you were inspired to start these programs and help others because you were a foster child yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So as a child, and it kind of happened in a short period of time. I didn't recognize the signs and symptoms then of what was going on with my mother at the time. I now, as an adult, I recognize that she was suffering from bipolar and schizophrenia and had a lot of mental health issues that were going on. And this was back in the early 80s, and things have moved forward tremendously when it comes to mental health. But she became ill. There was physical violence that was taking place in the home, not because she was disciplining me or anything like that. Just she had other things going on in her head at the time, if you will. And it got pretty bad, and I didn't disclose what was happening. It was something I kept a secret because I knew as soon as I opened my mouth and I said something, then things were going to change. As a child, what I wanted to do was I just wanted my mother to get better. I looked at that as kind of a, like when somebody has the flu or a cold, if you just wait around long enough, they tend to get better. So if I could kind of ride this out as long as I could, she was going to get better. Well, obviously mental health doesn't work that way. Somebody observed that something wasn't right, and it was reported, investigation was started. And even after that point, I still didn't disclose what was happening. But I did have some physical injuries that were very indicative of what was occurring. And at that time, that's when I had entered foster care. And it was just prior to my 8th birthday. I remained in the system until the age of 18. At that point, I aged out of the system. And even after that time, I really didn't talk about my experience as a child or anything like that. For many years, I just kind of kept quiet about it and that sort of thing until I started seeing really bad things happening to people that I grew up in foster care with. And it was things such as drug addiction, alcohol addiction. There were several suicides, fatal drug overdoses, mental health issues. And in a short period of time, 5 people that I grew up with in foster care had passed away. I went to 5 funerals in a very short period of time. And that was kind of the light bulb moment, if you will. Like, I really want to do something to change this. So I founded the Blue Ribbon Project. Nice. And it was more at that time just a website with resources for adult survivors of abuse.
Right. Well, my experience with foster care was a very short-lived experience because I was 15, and I went through maybe a couple of foster care homes. And when I got raped in one of them, I eventually ran away to the Miami Bridge. So, but for those that are just tuning in, this is The Cure. We're going to continue talking about these topics when we return. I'm your host, Amy Cabo, and today's show is focusing on the effects of abuse, how to recognize it, community programs for help, and please call to share your story. We're going to open the lines if you have any questions, and you'll have the opportunity to share or give us a call.
My mom will be very happy to hear from you. Please call us at 305-541-2350. Again, 305-541-2350.
This is Old Town Road by Lil Nas.
Take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the bushes black to match. Riding on a horse. Ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley. You ain't been up off that porch. Now, nah, can't nobody tell me nothing. A movie, bull riding in boots, cowboy hat from Gucci, Wrangler on my booty. Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me
Life can bring many difficult situations. Domestic violence, addictions, poverty, and even sexual abuse by your loved ones. The issue is not stay there, but to overcome all obstacles and show that with the love of God, your husband, and your family, you can succeed. Love is the answer, God is the cure, reveals from a very sincere and honest position Amy Cabo's life, a warrior who didn't give up and achieved the dream of her life. You can get to know more about her and her story on www.godisthecure.com or buying her book on amazon.com.
And now we continue with Amy Cabo and The Cure on 880 The Biz.
Welcome back to the show. For those that are tuning in with us, this is The Cure, and I'm your host, Amy Cabo, at 880 The Biz. If this is your first time tuning in, we typically focus on topics related to mental health, abuse, trauma, and treatment options. And today we are joined by Taylor Piles, and we are talking about how to recognize and prevent child abuse and community services that are available for adult survivors or children that are in the system, ways that you can help them or keep an eye on them.
So Detective Piles, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
So I know the importance of the Department of Children and Family, obviously, but I'm a little bit worried as far as the power that they have in certain situations. Instead of referring the matter to the police, and you are much more experienced in investigating certain matters, they would sometimes unilaterally make some decisions in some cases. Is that the case, or maybe I'm confused?
It really depends on the type of case. So oftentimes with neglect may not be reported to the police department. Again, that would be a matter of working with the families and things like that. Other things such as the more serious physical abuse cases and really all of the child sex offenses should be handled not handled by the police department, but most often our investigations. We kind of work side by side, hand in hand with the during the investigation. When it comes to if a child has to be removed from a home or placed into foster care or placed with relatives, things like that, then that will lie with Department of Family Services and other areas, Department of Social Services, and not so much the police department. The police department, their involvement will be more involved to see if there's a criminal matter or if they're going to seek criminal charges. And in a lot of cases, criminal charges are not sought. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but again, it might be a matter of working with families and that sort of thing. So if we have a serious physical case, and it was a matter of, poor parenting, if you will, and those parents, providing those parents some tools and things like that, they may not necessarily be charged with a crime, but in the more serious ones, they likely will be charged.
But so this is happening because I don't know. For example, my wife's case, it's very weird. So the state kind of filed some case against her stepfather, but I don't know if you're familiar, but maybe she'll tell a bit later. But kind of there was no criminal charges filed. They were just seeking protection for the kids. It's very weird because her case was very strong. There was documented sexual abuse. And the judge even ruled that the stepfather did what he did, but then there was never criminal charges found. So is that like a difference? I mean, like the two systems don't get together? Isn't it more important actually the police and the justice system to be involved in those cases?
Is there a disconnect?
That's the word I was looking.
And sometimes there is, and again, it depends on the relationship that a local police department will have with their local social services. Where I'm at, I'm fortunate that we have a really good relationship
That's
with them.
Great.
We work, you know, side by side. But in other places of the country, you know, things may be very, very different. And ultimately, in some cases, the case or the circumstances might be reviewed by a prosecutor's office to see if they want to pursue charges in that regard. And there might be a variety of reasons why they elect not to pursue criminal charges. Again, it doesn't mean that didn't happen, but they start looking at things from a trial standpoint to determine, you know, is this something that they can successfully prosecute in trial, or are they going to do more trauma to that child? In Amy's case, Amy said you were 15 years old.
Yes.
At that point, you're a little bit older. But if you think of a younger child, is it always better to put, you know, I mean, you have to think about putting a small child on a witness stand and have them have to testify to what happened to them and things like that. There's a whole variety of things that can go into consideration, you know, if they're going to pursue criminal charges. And unfortunately, oftentimes the victims or their families may not be aware of what all those circumstances are or why they elected not to pursue charges. And that's kind of unfortunate, because I think sometimes victims feel that they weren't believed and that sort of thing. And that's really not the case. It's they are believed. It's a matter of can they get a successful prosecution out of that versus putting a child on the stand and that sort of thing.
Yeah, because this perpetrator can actually continue doing it again and again.
Yes, yes.
And it doesn't help that there are times that the victim sometimes is re-victimized and there's victim blaming. And I think that's all changing now with the Me Too movement.
Yes.
And, yep. You know, I'm hopeful, and I know there's a lot of good things happening. So little by little, I think we can be there for one another. And that's why I like to have different guests on the show, because we can all come together and we can all find a way to help one another, because we're still learning. We're always learning. I don't pretend to know everything. I'm just giving my testimony, see if it helps. That's basically it. We're just, you know, just doing it together. But tell us how, if somebody needed your services, for example, somebody needed some kind of support being an adult survivor, or somebody is maybe suspecting but is afraid to call the 800 number, wants to be anonymous, what kind of things, what kind of resources can people that may find it difficult to report, where can they turn to, or what kind of therapies are available?
Yeah, well, the one thing that they would want to do if they suspect that abuse is going on is to report that to the local social service agencies for whatever county or jurisdiction that they're in. Contacting a third party wouldn't necessarily be the right way to go with that. There's going to be a variety of questions and things like that they're going to ask that person and that sort of thing. One of the things that when it comes to adult survivors of abuse is to seek out others, whether it's therapy or support groups. We do have a list of resources on our website that is blueribbonproject.org. But we'll have those resources, because one of the things with adult survivors of abuse, and I'm sure Amy, you kind of felt this way as well, is you feel like you're alone. You feel like almost like you're the only person that this has happened to. And it is shocking the amount of people that it actually has happened to. And it's when those, you know, when you tend to find each other and, you know, offer that support for each other, saying, hey, this happened to me too. And that's one of the things with the Me Too movement that you mentioned has really taken off, is more people are coming forward. And again, it may not necessarily be for criminal charges or a criminal investigation and things like that, but you have adult survivors of abuse that are coming together saying, this happened to me. I've struggled throughout my life with a variety of issues because of it. And kind of, you know, being there, as you said, being there for each other is tremendous. That's what inspired me to come forward. I never talked about and shared my story until talking to other survivors and things like that. And over time, it became a process, you know, for me. And it's a lifelong process, and that's kind of an unfortunate thing. I entered foster care at the age of 7. I'm now 45 years old, and it's still a healing process for me. I'm still healing every day.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, not every day is easy for me. Not every day is happy. I still have challenges. It's just much easier with God in my life, which is why I named this show The Cure, because that's what The Cure was to me. I'm a guinea pig. I tried everything. Trust me. I know this. But, you know, us survivors, we also deal with other things like stigma, you know, what people think of us, whether they'll think we're broken, whether they won't believe in us, whether they'll judge us, whether they'll see us the same way. And it's happening. It's very much happening. I'll give you an example. My daughter handed out my memoir in her school. Now I'm not allowed to volunteer. There's a good example. So, you know, Catholic, what can I say? I'm still Catholic, don't worry. So, but, you know, people are afraid. And what's beautiful about support groups and being there for one another is that, you know, sometimes you can't get somebody out of it until you've been through it. And these are people that are willing to accept you, that are not willing to judge, that are not going to judge you, that are not going to take a second guess, that are not going to think you're lying, that are not going to accuse you or blame you. And that's what's important, acceptance, unconditional love. It's a really good thing.
Yes.
And let me just mention the abuse hotline in Florida is 1-800-962-2873 or Florida Relay 711.
Yes, and you know, if you suspect that you do want to call those numbers and make that report, and in most cases you can actually remain anonymous. From a police standpoint and criminal investigations, I would like to have that person's information only because I can ask more questions and follow up. But I don't necessarily. I'm not going to share with the family saying, Mrs. Jones down the street called the police on you and that sort of stuff. So you can remain anonymous in a lot of ways, but we may have some additional questions.
But if you have questions to that person reported, you can contact him or her.
Yes.
I like to report everything that I find odd or unusual or out of the way because I rather err on the side of safety.
Yeah.
And I'd like to believe that children and families, it's usually the case that children and families are helping children and are saving children from abusive situations rather than the other way around. Children and families are abusing a family, which is how my parents described it in the case from hell.
Well, yeah, obviously people need to be aware of when you have custody disputes, some family members might report the other family member on spite.
Well, the media liked that story.
Yeah.
The system, children and families abusing two doctor parents with 9 children. What a nice family. How could this be? Well, and, you know, it's sociopaths. They can easily fool you, easily manipulate, which makes you so interesting because I heard that you do forensic interviews. So you have a world of information. And what I wanted to ask you, that how do we know somebody is lying? Would you believe that when I came out at 15 and I told about all my abuses, the detective in the case did not believe me? She said I was lying because I was looking down the whole time. And I was looking down the whole time because I was ashamed. And the only ones that believed me was the guardian ad litem, the attorney, the social worker, and thank God, the judge, which is why my stepfather never got to work as a pediatrician. So, but that's what I wanted to ask you when you come back, is how can we tell who's lying? Tell me about the interviews of Leaving Neverland. How can we know? I mean, tell us a little bit about that when we come back. And for those who are tuning in, this is The Cure. I'm your host, Amy Cabo. And we're talking about topics of abuse and everything. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about these things. We're live every Friday. You're welcome to call in.
My mom would be very happy to hear from you. Please call at Please, my mom would.
Go ahead. It's okay.
It won't pick up.
It will pick up. Go for it.
My mom will be very happy to hear from you. Please call us at 305-541-2350. Again, 305-541-2350.
Thank you, Michelle.
This is Bad Liar by Imagine Dragons.
My dear, it's been a difficult year. Terrorists don't prey on innocent victims. Trust me, darling. Trust me, darling. It's been about this year. I'm a
situations, domestic violence, addictions, poverty, and even sexual abuse by your loved ones. The issue is not stay there, but to overcome all obstacles and show that with the love of God, your husband, and your family, you can succeed. Love is the answer, God is the cure, reveals from a very sincere and honest position Amy Cabo's life, a warrior who didn't give up and achieved the dream of her life. You can get to know more about her and her story on www.godisthecure.com or buying her book on amazon.com.
And now we continue with Amy Cabo and The Cure on 880 The Biz.
Hi, we're back. Thanks for joining us. This is The Cure, and I'm your host, Amy Cabo. Guys, please call us. Tell us about your struggles, your concerns, your questions, your triumphs, whatever may be at mind. It's incredible how we can be there for one another, and you have no idea who you may be helping just by your testimony or what answer you may, or what question you may be answering with your questions. And I have a question for Taylor Piles about lying. Okay, when I was a kid, because I was looking down, the detective thought that I was lying, and I don't know if they have a protocol or they go by textbook. I mean, I know that a psychiatrist, when I went into the medical records, said there was absolutely no hope for me. Well, guess what? There was hope for me. So it's not always by textbook. It's not always by protocol. It's not always that way, right?
It's not. And, you know, it's unfortunate that you had, you know, that happened to you in that part of the process with that. Because there's, to be honest with you, there's really no surefire way to tell if somebody is, you know, lying or not, especially, you know, in the type of abuse that you had gone through. The thing to kind of keep in mind is, you know, over the years, processes have changed. The system, if you will, has changed. Forensic interviewing has come a long way. And I do, you mentioned that the detective didn't believe you because you had been looking down the whole time. And that may have been something that was taught at one point or another. That's not so much the case now. Usually it's you take all the circumstances and the entire interview as a whole, and kind of base your findings on that. And one of the things that often happens in our interviews is they're going to be audio and video recorded, and others will, such as a prosecutor, will also review that interview and that sort of stuff. So it's not relying solely on one person to make a determination. You know, is this child lying or is that child not lying? And my personal philosophy is, even if you have your doubts and things like that, you have to tread carefully about telling a child that they're lying about, you know, that abuse. And that, you know, that can be an issue because, you know, such as, you know, like in your case where you're not lying, you know, the additional trauma that you're adding to that, what's going on with that child by saying, I don't believe you, you know, that can be a tremendous thing. And that's something that, you know, is really inappropriate, you know, at this time, but it's something that has advanced over, you know, over the years. We know a lot more about forensic interviews. It used to be, you know, many years ago when I entered foster care, it was a patrol officer that interviewed me. It wasn't a detective. It wasn't somebody that really had any experience with child abuse or anything like that. You know, the most knowledgeable person at that time was the social worker that had been assigned, you know, that case. And it's not that the police did anything wrong or anything like that in my case. But it was a matter of, it was somebody that didn't have any experience. And oftentimes when you're talking to children, you know, you're going to interview a child much differently than you would an adult that you suspect of a bank robbery or something like that. You know, so when you're talking to that child, it's very, very different now. And as I said, forensic interviewing has come a long, long way when we're working with children, you know, in that regard.
I mean, I was very fortunate because for me, I was able to tape record my father admitting to everything, but not everybody gets that. And these things can happen. And I know that people lie. I mean, it's possible that people can lie, but I find it very hard to believe that a child would lie about something like this. Who wants to be seen in that way or to be seen like a victim? And we're usually very ashamed of what we've been through, like if it's something we did wrong. So why would someone voluntarily, especially a child, make up such a thing? So I would say I would most probably believe a child if a child is telling you something like that, or I would believe an adult. Like, for example, not too long ago, I watched the documentary Leaving Neverland. And, you know, people say they have different opinions about this. But I'm thinking to myself, when I saw those men talk about what happened with Michael Jackson, their experiences, and the way that they went into detail, having been abused myself and having been a survivor, I felt like they were saying the truth. What's your take on that?
I believe them 100% as well. I believe that they were being truthful. And some oftentimes the argument that we, you know, that we hear for those that don't believe, you know, well, why did they wait so long? And, you know, we're seeing that a lot with the, you know, the Me Too movement. Think of Bill Cosby and Brett Kavanaugh and, you know, with the Michael Jackson thing. You know, why did they wait so many years before they talked about it? They must be making it up because they didn't tell right away. And I'm cringing as I'm watching all this stuff going on, thinking that's how it usually happens. Is, you know, it's rare that the child actually comes forward that day and says, "Hey, this is happening to me." You know, as an investigator, that's what we want. We want them to come forward right away for a variety of reasons. But the reality of it is, oftentimes they wait years or decades if they ever talk about it. So the fact that, you know, listening to these guys talk, the fact that they waited so long really doesn't play a factor in whether I believe them or not. But like you, looking at their statements and things like that, and then thinking back over the trial, you know, many years ago, and you know, and with that, and as me being somebody who loves music, and I was a big fan of Michael Jackson, it was kind of heartbreaking to know that was going on, because it changed my entire outlook on him and things like that. But I believe him.
Abusers are usually very nice and very nobody would ever believe that they would do something like this. It's the last thing
I have a question
that people think of.
Sure. Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
I always wonder, I mean, if the whole Michael Jackson thing, what always surprises me or I'm curious about is, why has no one ever asked who abused Michael Jackson all those years? What might have created that? And what in his childhood would have made him that way? And no one ever touches on that. So I don't know if anyone has a thought with that, but that just, I mean, and that's probably me coming defending Michael Jackson because I was such a big fan. But, you know, I just want to know the reason why did this guy, why, what made that guy,
well,
if he was that?
It's a disease, Wanda.
Because, I mean, I know, but but we don't talk about his abuse at all.
Here's the thing. We all know that politics can be ugly and people are capable of lying. So I'm more likely to believe an adult that has details than an adult that does not have details.
Okay.
And when do you know it's a fugue state? And when do you know it's really the person doesn't know what to say because they're making it up? Can you tell me a little bit about that, Detective?
Well, so the thing with you know, Michael Jackson, and there was a rumor, and I don't know if it was, you know, explored, you know, much more beyond that. It is possible that he was a victim of something himself, but sometimes I wonder if a lot of it came from his own success. He was very isolated and things like that. And one of the things, especially when it comes to sex offenders such as that, if you think of Michael Jackson and his love of children, in his mind, he was not harming these children. He was, you know, being affectionate with them. And it sounds strange, but there's a whole process behind that. So his goal wasn't to harm anybody or anything like that. I think he genuinely loved children, if you will. But it was, you know, very inappropriate where he took it. So I sometimes doubt if he was a victim himself or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that, you know, as you know, was mentioned that it's really never talked about it. As far as I know, he's never disclosed anything. I think there may have been some physical abuse in the home. I know their father was relatively a very strong disciplinarian in the home and that. But I don't know whatever happened with him. But even then, it still doesn't negate what he's
no.
you know what he's done. But in his mind, and that's often the case with these sex offenders, is their goal is not to their goal is not to harm the children. They don't feel like they're causing that child harm.
That's why they're sick, because they're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. It's actually a clinical diagnosis, right? Pedophile.
Yeah, when he cared for these children, he legitimately cared for them, if that makes sense. And when we're talking about sex offenders, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around sometimes.
Yeah.
With that, but it's different than other crimes. He's not trying to harm them, and that's why there's so much that goes into keeping them quiet. There's so much, you know, you hear about buying off the families, and I think the one mother had her house paid off, you know, by Michael Jackson, and, you know, when you hear those things happening, that's, you know, that's kind of him making up for that.
Yes, and I get that, you know, because my stepfather was super nice. He was the docile one, the passive aggressive. My mother was the scary one. And so these people appear to be very nice, but I find it pretty odd, an adult that wants to be around children all the time. I just don't know if it's normal. I mean, I think my stepfather was attracted to my mother because she came to him, married him with 5 children, and they had some more. So they just, I would really be weary of an adult that just likes to be around children all the time.
Yes. Yes.
You know, that's out of the ordinary, don't you think?
Yes.
Did he even think he was a man? I mean, he was a man child. I don't know. It's so sad.
The
whole thing is sad. I don't think he even saw himself as a man.
Well, even the survivor said, you know, you see us, we're an adult, but we're just a kid in an adult body.
Got it.
And I thought that was very interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yes, and that's a really good, good statement, because I think that kind of goes into that, what's going on in his head, if you will. With that, he feels like he's a child playing with another child and didn't really see it as inappropriate. But hold on.
So he didn't know it's inappropriate, you think?
No, that's why they're sick. They're not aware of it. They need help. Yeah. That's what they need.
I mean, I don't agree with that. This is a disease. They can't stop themselves, but they know it's inappropriate because they have enough intelligence to realize that the law doesn't allow it.
And they hide it.
And they hide it.
But it's like you being celibate.
But they hide it. They don't say it out openly. I mean,
it'd be great if they knew they had a problem and they'd get help for it.
Well, that's the
thing. But unfortunately, we find out a little late.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and by inappropriate, I think where our disconnect is, we're looking at it from a criminal aspect.
Right.
Yes, he knows it's against the law, but may not necessarily see it as wrong because in his mind and his heart, what he believes is he's caring for them, he's loving them, he's showing them love and affection, same as adult with spouses do. And I think that's that mindset. So when I say, inappropriate, not necessarily from a lawful manner, but what he's kind of seeing in his head, with that, yes, he knows it's wrong. He knows it's against the law, and he knows that if word gets out, then he's probably going to go to jail. But the way he feels that he's caring for others and things like that, and I think that's the mind that he had.
Mm-hmm. Taylor, please tell us how people can get in touch with you, your website, how they can get involved with these programs, maybe if you can help them or if they can volunteer, however way.
Yeah, because the show goes into a podcast, and it's also going to be probably distributed through syndicated radio stations as well all over the United States.
Wonderful. So our website is blueribbonproject.org. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are 100% volunteer organization. When I founded the organization, I've got a full-time job with the police department, and I wanted to help people. So we have no paid staff. We're 100% volunteer, so it's all about volunteers. It's all about raising awareness. There's a couple of different ways people can help, and if they're not local, if there's not a chapter near them with that, we're always looking for adult survivors of abuse, trying to connect these groups. And if people want to share their stories, even if they want to remain anonymous, they can send those articles to us, because our hope is when they see stories from other survivors and what they've gone through and how they've started that healing process, is that they can be inspired by reading that. And that's what it really is about, is helping, these adult survivors of abuse. So a lot of that information can be found on our website. It's blueribbonproject.org. And just kind of help us raise awareness of what's going on in our communities. It's more commonplace than many people realize.
And awareness is so important, because really education is key. But we've come to the end of the show again. A big thank you for all of you who have been listening. And a big thank you to you, Tyler. Thank you for joining us. It was wonderful talking about these topics, and we've had a world of information. We look forward to doing this again next Friday. See you then. This is The Cure. I'm your host, Amy Cabo, and this is Thunder by Imagine Dragons.
Thanks. Thank you.
With the quick fuse, I was uptight, wanna let loose. I was dreaming of bigger things and wanna leave my old life behind. Not a yes, sir, not a follower. Fit the box, fit the mold, have a seat in the foyer. Take a number. I was lightning before the thunder.
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 Well, I was scheming for the masses. Who do you think you are? Dreaming about being a big star. They say you're basic, they say you're easy. You're always riding in the backseat. Now I'm smiling from the stage while you were clapping in the nosebleeds.
Lightning and the thunder.